August, and it is 1:30 p.m. This is Talk on the Rock, and I'm your host, Colette Czarnecki. Today, we are bringing back a guest who spoke just a little bit last week with her husband, Tanaya, and that's Lindsay Morelli. So after last week's interview, I found out she, of course, has her own story that's super fascinating and interesting. Again, if any other Wranglites feel like they have a story they would like to share, please feel free and reach out to KSDK for a future Talk on the Rock. You can call in to ask a question. The number to KSDK is 874-2345. Hi, Lindsay. How are you today?
Hello. I'm doing great.
Great. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm really excited to learn more. So what I found out about you last week was that you helped train sea lions and dolphins in the Navy's Marine Mammal Program.
I did.
It's amazing. Will you talk about this experience?
Yeah, of course. It was right out of college, so I was like just super young, super eager. My ex was going into a military program down there out of Coronado, the Navy SEAL program, and it worked out simultaneous that I could get into this program. So I was like, yes. So, because science was always like, I just am fascinated with it, all aspects of science, nutritional, medicinal, but specifically on the animal side of it. And so being able to work with sea lions and dolphins, like, not only was it a dream come true, but it became this like overall just amazing experience to see it like firsthand, working with veterinarians like on the Army side and the civilian side, and then working with like Navy divers, the explosive ordnance disposal EOD guys for the Navy, and then just a lot of also like other just trainers in general, which is really cool.
Wow. How long did you do that for?
It was just for one specific year, only because he was in the SEAL program, but he ended up getting rolled out of it for fractures in his shins during Hell Week, and they moved him to Florida within like a 5-day period. So I was in that, like, I have to decide if I'm going with him or if I'm staying here doing this forever.
Where were you?
In San Diego. Oh. So we lived in Coronado, but the on Point Loma, which is the peninsula across the bay, there's a submarine base there, and it's like a security clearance to get onto it, and that's where I was actually working. So we worked across the bay from each other.
Oh, wow.
At that point, so I was looking at my house or I was looking at work just across the way. So I should have just bought a kayak and just kayaked to work. But it was a really cool experience. So like initially getting into it, it's an internship that you do through college and you can get a scholarship to go there. And like they interview you, they do a couple of phone interviews type of thing to get into the program, based on interests and capabilities and what schooling you've done and et cetera, et cetera. And so you're kind of taking classes while you're going to this program.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of fun. But you get so much experience just, one, caretaking, you know, animal, keeping up all your responsibilities, like feeding them, making sure that they're healthy, cleaning all of their cages or water pens or anything. But a lot of it is like you're making sure that they're healthy. Because for this particular program, the dolphins and sea lions are considered part of like the military. And so they're really well taken care of.
And they're not rescued.
No,
seals.
Sometimes the sea lions are rescued. Like, okay. If a mom has passed away, then they rescue the pups and raise them from pup stage all the way up. And so they last, I mean, typically they last about 3 times longer than they would in the wild just because they're well taken care of and they're trained and they get to do a lot of cool things with people.
Yeah. So did you help train them?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
Well, with a sea lion, it's really fun. So it's kind of like dog training, but you get to add the underwater process as well because they got fins. And so you get to do a lot of fun things and teach them a lot of, you teach them tricks like you would a dog, sit, all those different things. But you get to add in all these things like, hey, go attach this thing to that thing because we need to bring it up off the bottom. So they don't see it as anything different than they're doing what you're asking them to do and they get a big fish treat at the end of it.
How did you communicate with them?
Sometimes whistles, sometimes like motions, sometimes noises, like similar to how you would train a dog. And with dolphins specifically, typically you would use a whistle. But they also are very keen on your hand motions. And so you can do different things with your hands and they are watching you. And then they accordingly, they'll beach up into a zodiac or they'll present their tail to you or they'll go and do a flip up in the air, you know, just to have some fun things as well.
Oh my goodness.
Because sometimes we would have dolphins that would go to SeaWorld or come from SeaWorld, so they knew a lot of fun tricks too, like you see if you're going to one of their shows.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And How much time does it take, you know, usually? I mean, it probably varies, but yeah. How much time does it take on average?
I guess it depends on how old they are, you know, because dolphins can live a long time, and I guess sea lions as well. And so with sea lions, I mean, they pick it up very quickly because they're very food motivated. And so it's pretty easy in that sense because they want to please you, and both of them do. It's funny with the dolphins because once in a while you'll know, like, they're not going to listen to me right now, because they'll go to the other side of the pen, just kind of look at you, and you're like, I'm going to come back. Because you got to do it on their time. Because it's not like you're going to say, okay, now get over here right now, because that's not the way it works. But having a good relationship with them, it makes it to where they want to come to you. Because a lot of the stuff that we do training-wise is out in San Diego Bay or outside of that. So it's like they have the option of coming or going. And so creating an environment where they want to beach up into your Zodiac or the sea lions jumping back up in there with their plates, because they have these bite plates and they can actually go down to, you know, lots of meters to go and attach them to these foreign objects, which for military purposes could be foreign objects, like Navy divers, swimmers, like, you know, objects that they're trying to say, is this something that's dangerous to our fleet, our people, whoever it is?
Yeah.
And so it's pretty cool. And they would use them for research purposes too, like noise underwater and seeing how that would affect marine mammal life. And they're actually starting to incorporate in like video game type stuff as well, just in terms of just abilities and different things in terms of cognition, which is
that's so fascinating. Okay so the sea lions, what do the dolphins do?
They do the same. They actually, because they can dive so much deeper, like it's easier for the sea lions to get in and around like pilings and stuff, like in like nav, like just quick navigation within that. But dolphins can go a lot deeper and stay under for a lot longer time. And they have a lot more force. So when it comes to like an enemy diver, like over in like an international port like Bahrain, they can patrol and patrol and patrol, and they can find an enemy swimmer or see something that may not necessarily be, like, they know there's something not, they're off.
Wow.
And they can just tag it, and it's attached to a buoy, and then from there it gets turned over to the actual guys.
Do you know how far, you know, the sea mammals, the dolphins, the sea lions, how far they go out from, like, the base where they work, I guess?
Typically it's with a trainer or with the group. Okay. And so they typically don't just like send them away from base.
Yeah.
Unless they're like with one of the crafts. Like a lot of times they're in the boat and then they take them out, and then from there they're diving out and around. And then in the international ports, or like in Georgia or up in Washington, and like there's like three different facilities within the US, they kind of train in different, you know, water temperatures in different places, so they can get more exposure to just more than one place.
Wow.
But it's not like you're like a homing pigeon where you're like, hey, go over there and come back.
I did recently read a article on that.
Yeah.
Homing pigeons. Wow. So cool. So what was the favorite part? Like, can you just share with us like a favorite memory that you had doing that?
I love getting sea lion kisses. They're the best. Little whiskers all over your cheeks. Oh. I mean, that was always fun. But something that they were kind of in the works of starting and had like preliminarily started was a breeding program with the dolphins specifically. And so the day a baby dolphin was born was probably one of the highlights of being at the facility. It was pretty amazing.
Oh my
gosh. Just how small they are and just how much they depend on their moms. But being a part of that was a pretty cool experience.
Wow. How small are they?
Oh my gosh.
As newborns?
They're little. I mean, they're just a couple feet. Like they're just
a couple feet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, probably like that. And like she's helping them come to the surface every time to take a breath.
Wow.
But yeah, pretty cool. But doing the veterinary side, it was like, I love that aspect of it as well. And so there was, at one point, we were doing surgery on one of the sea lion's fins because it had gotten severely infected. And so we actually had to do a partial removal of one of the fins.
Oh my goodness. So. Wow. And then do you know if that sea lion was still working mm-hmm. after?
Yep. We had a little nub. He was very cute.
Oh, what was his name?
Oh gosh, I don't remember. There were so many that came through. It was like, I don't even remember the name.
Yeah.
It was a really cool experience.
How long ago was this?
Oh, it was right out of college. 2012?
Okay.
12, 13, yeah.
Cool. So, yeah. So you're originally from Idaho?
Mm-hmm.
And that was in California. What brought you to Alaska?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my mom grew up here. My grandma and grandpa, Al and Ruby Taylor, they moved up here when she was six. And so that was kind of the beginning of my beginnings, knowing what Alaska was, because this is just like my mom loves being here. Like, this is her home and always has been. And so she was up here her whole life doing sports. And my grandparents worked at the high school for a long time, just all the schools, I guess. And my dad moved up here when he was 18, 19 to help his older sister out. She had a couple little boys and she was here on her own at that point. So he came to help her out and ended up meeting my mom. Yeah. So instead of going to school himself, he asked her to marry him.
And,
wow. Yeah. So my older two siblings, Dan Powers, who actually now lives here as well, which was a huge shift for me, thinking that I was going to be on this island alone. Now I have my brother here and my mom and dad are always back and forth and this is their home.
Yeah.
And so it's been pretty neat. So it wasn't an intentional stay, but things like life just kind of happened and it created an avenue to where I got to stay, because we'd come up every summer, like this was summer and fishing and the 4th of July and the Scrapfish Derby and all the games. And so that was always part of my growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. And what year did you settle here?
I came up in 2017 and I got my grandma and brought her down to Idaho for all of the holidays, for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And she got in a pretty bad accident in January of 2018. And she didn't end up making it. They ended up medevacing her to us in Idaho. And she passed away and went back to the Lord there. And so we brought her home to actually bury her here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, she was such a staple in this town. Like, I have people that come up to me that I don't even know talking to me about my grandma Ruby. So I know the impact that she had on this community. Yeah. And it's one of those legacies that you kind of just want to always, like, represent and live well in that. Like, I mean, to say someone, if someone ever told me, like, you remind me of your grandma Ruby, like, I'd be ready to go home. Because she was so wonderful.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So then I ended up staying after that point full time, which has been quite an experience. Because up until then, I had moved, like, 13 times in 4 years with the military stuff from Idaho and California and Florida and Virginia. And so,
yeah, you sent me, you know, a little text resume, and and I noticed that. And so that was all with the military, you moving around.
Yeah, the moving around was part of the military. I was working as a civilian, but it took me to a lot of cool places.
Yeah. And one of them, we're just gonna stick with the water, the marine life right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you worked at the Virginia Beach Aquarium as a member of the stranding response team. What was that about?
So, I mean, yes, they have their regular employees that work within the aquarium itself, but there was a particular team that would actually be an outreach program. So anytime a call would come in for an injured animal, a deceased animal, or an unknown animal, they would send out this stranding response team to go pick it up or to go investigate. So sometimes it would be a sea turtle or a sea lion or a dolphin or a whale or a deer. Like, just people would just, they would call into this particular number and we would go investigate. And oftentimes we would bring it back to the facility to rehab it if it was something that could be rehabbed, like a turtle that got hit by a prop or a sick sea lion. But a lot of times it was recovering a deceased animal, and then we would do what they call a necropsy, which is kind of like a surgery after they're dead to figure out why it passed away.
Yeah. Did you perform that?
I helped. Yeah, we were a part of it. It was kind of a team. And so, like, there was somebody that led it, and then we would all be assisting in that process.
Wow. What was that like?
Very smelly.
Yeah.
Very smelly.
Do you know, like, what was the oldest creature that you did a necropsy on?
I would imagine a sea turtle, but I wouldn't actually remember the exact age of them. But oftentimes they would pass away just from getting hit by a boat or some sickness or something like that. And so a lot of times you knew exactly why it had passed away. But there was just that, it's just part of living where people live.
Yeah. And how much time has passed, like, from their death to the...
It depended on if they washed up immediately or if it took them a while to wash up. But typically it was within the same week.
Okay.
Just someone would find it on the beach while they're walking or driving past or on a boat or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you would ship, like, parts of, you know, the biopsy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we do a lot of it right there at, like, they kind of had a lab facility, but a lot of times, yeah, they'd send certain blood samples or biopsy samples to see, like, is there some kind of a disease or, like, a disorder or something that's actually going on to prevent it from spreading if that was the case.
Yeah. Wow. Did your team ever send out animals for other rehab areas, you know, like I know in Florida there's a turtle hospital, mm-hmm. and
there, if there was a need to, like if we didn't have enough space in there, then there was, they would send it to different facilities, like specific to like, okay, this one's not going to go back into the wild. But the hope was that we could, you know, you don't give them enough human contact, but you're like, rehabilitating them,
yeah.
to where they could go back into the wild.
How was that job? Was that difficult?
No, not necessarily. I think every like death obviously was sad, but everyone that was able to be rehabbed and let go was always a win. And so it was like it was, and if you could help, like why did this animal, like why was it deceased? And it was something that could help further in the research of preventing something from happening.
Yeah, definitely.
So it was rewarding in all of those sense. And it got you out on the beaches of, you know, all over the place. Sometimes you're like, you're going 50 miles to go find something.
Yeah, yeah. That's really awesome. And wait, how long did you do that for?
That was for a year, year and a half.
Okay. And then you also, still in the water, you were a Nightingale Charters deckhand.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were a part owner. Where was that and for how long?
That is here in Wrangell.
Oh, never mind. Yeah. Sorry.
You weren't here yet, though, so that's not your fault. So Nightingale Charters is actually that we, Tania started that back, he moved here in 13, and about 15, he kind of branched off onto his own. And Nightingale is his grandma's maiden name. And so he kind of took a nautical spin on that and turned it into the G-A-L-E, Nightingale.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we did that for a long time. And just a couple years back, I've kind of tapered it off and officially went full-time construction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So no more Nightingale.
No more Nightingale.
Okay. And
At least in terms of chartering.
Yeah. What were you all doing?
It was really fun. I mean, you got you out on the water. I mean, sometimes we were out, you know, 90 to 100 days in a row. So it's a lot. Like you're up to 11, you know, up at 4 a.m. And so it was, you know, you got to meet a lot of cool people off the ship. So we made a lot of really amazing friends with that. But, you know, you're taking people out to experience, you know, throwing out a few crab pots or shrimp pots and different things. But we would take them out specifically to catch different species of salmon, you know, and then rockfish, lingcod, halibut. So most people that came off of cruise ships, they were looking for halibut or salmon. But when we had our own clients, then we could take them to different places because they'd be here for a new extended amount of time.
Yeah.
So we could target different species, and people always wanted to come back. So cool. That was really fun.
Do you still get phone calls from people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Luckily, Marlon and Alan are still here, so we can refer them to somebody. But
okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like, well, I'm sorry.
How's the construction business?
Very busy. So our house is included in that right now. So it's a lot happening. But we're glad to have this winter to be able to do some home renovations along with other people's. But we have new home builds on the docket for this year and new roofs on the docket. And it seems that there's no never ending supply of people needing help with construction stuff. So we're glad to be in the business, which is something that I grew up in because my dad was a custom home builder growing up. He switched now to spray foam insulation, which is also an awesome thing. But my whole life he was building homes, other than when I was really little, he worked for Alaska Airlines.
Oh, wow.
Which is what he did when he was here in Wrangell, too.
Wow. So did he work for Alaska Airlines here and elsewhere?
Yeah, that was part of what, because he grew up in Colorado, which was like 300 days of sunshine, which is not Wrangell. coming to Wrangell was kind of a weather shock for him. And so they ended up compromising. And initially we're in Boise, which is all sunshine and brown hills, and that's actually where I was born. But that's so opposite of Wrangell, it was hard for my mom. And so they ended up settling in North Idaho area, like Eastern Washington and the North Idaho, which is very similar to here. When you go like Ponderay Lake, like a lot of evergreens, big water, and the temperatures and like just how it feels is a lot more similar, but less rain. So my dad was a lot happier with that.
Is it in North Idaho, is it sunny still? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
They get a lot more sun. They get a lot more heat in the summer times. And so, and two of my siblings still live in that area.
Yeah. So two there, two here, mm-hmm. including yourself.
Yeah.
Do you have any other siblings? Is it four of you total?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Not like Tania. We know all of our siblings. Yes. There's two boys and two girls.
Okay. Okay. Yep. Cool.
And a little niece on the way.
Oh. Well, welcome.
So, yeah.
Soon. So, okay. We're jumping out of the waters now. And you spent 6 months in New Zealand.
Yeah.
What inspired you to go there and when did you go there?
So it was right out of college. I actually graduated early, which was, I don't remember sleeping that last semester because I was a biochemistry major for Northwest Nazarene University. I got a Bachelor of Science in biochem. And so it's it's a lot of just like intensive classes and they're very demanding. And so to graduate, like, I was motivated because I knew where I was going. So it was worth it. And I was also on a track scholarship initially at NNU. And then I switched over to soccer my junior year.
Oh, wow.
But going to New Zealand was just, I love nature. Like if I could just be in nature 24/7, I would be really happy.
Yeah.
It's just, I feel at home there and it's just at peace there. And so New Zealand is very much that way. I think my initial thought was that I was going to be going to a missionary school in Australia. My mom was freaked out by that idea because there's a lot of poisonous things. And according to her, a lot of boys that might want me to stay in Australia. And so it ended up being New Zealand at 6 months. And I actually went with my ex and he is a hunting fanatic. So that was kind of his motivation. But we got to see a lot of them, like flew into the North Island and explored it all and ended up staying and living on the South Island.
Wow. I have a friend who hiked and I don't even, there's a trail in mm-hmm. New Zealand. Did you do that? Or do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know specifically which one. Is it kind of like a PCT or something like that? Yeah. Of the sort? Okay. I didn't do a full trail, but we did a lot of trails, but nothing from like top to bottom or bottom to top. But,
right.
But a lot of in the mountain ranges and the southern islands where there's just a lot of up. And it's just very beautiful. And like at the time, like Lord of the Rings was such a huge thing and like going to all the different sites, but I'm not very a touristy person, and so we would go to find the sites that like were on the Lord of the Rings map, like find the ones that were not on the map, which is pretty neat.
Oh, cool. Wow. Okay, so will you just give us a memorable day that you had in New Zealand and like just describe what you saw and what was that like and all of that?
So the same weekend, it was kind of like navigating from East Coast to West Coast on the Southern Island, and we lived in Dunedin, which is like the southernmost university of New Zealand, like University of Otago, and they would do a lot of research out of Antarctica and different things in that area. But on the eastern coast is a place called the Meraki Boulders, and they're perfectly round, and they literally, like, as the sand erodes away, they fall out of the sand, but they're anywhere from little to like where you could get inside of them, these giant but perfectly round boulders. Like it just looks like a land full of like, I don't know, dinosaur eggs or just like prehistoric. But it was like, you couldn't just like make that happen. So you just stood there just like, what am I looking at? So like going from that coast to the opposite coast, which is like the Fiordlands, which is like misty and jungly and just like you could get lost in about 5 seconds if you don't know where you're at kind of. But we were specifically looking for red stag in the wild just to see them in the wild versus like going onto a hunting ranch or different things. And unlike what we're used to, which was elk and they bugle, red stag roar. And it's like this very deep kind of guttural just like roar.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And you heard them? You
yes.
saw them?
Yeah. So we were calling for them. And that was probably the most memorable, was being camping in the middle of nowhere, just, you know, in a little two-man tent. Or just even in sleeping bags on the ground and hearing them in just out there with you, just roaring. So it made you feel like you were living with dinosaurs.
Wow. And then you saw those huge boulders. Mm-hmm. And wow. Yeah. How long was that camping trip for?
It was just for like a 4-day, like from a Friday to a Monday.
Okay.
So it was just like seeing a whole bunch at once. And then on the very southern tip, there's little penguins and little yellow-eyed penguins. And they live in little burrows up off the water. And so that was probably the most happy memory, because watching them try to get through the rocks, and half the time they're falling and slipping and just, but they never gave up. And so it was like so funny watching them just like slipping up these rocks, but it was like, it was a good, like, just never give up because you know where you're going.
Wow. That's a great, yeah. That's awesome. That's really awesome. And how did you feel leaving New Zealand and you came back to the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was hard. I mean, I definitely miss my family. It's always like you're like a whole day ahead, basically. And so like to watch the soccer World Cup, like you had to stay up to like 1, 2, 3 in the morning because the times were so different to be able to watch it. But that particular year, the All Blacks, the New Zealand team, like they actually made it to that. So it was like a fun getting to be there while they're going into the soccer. It was really fun.
Really
but
cool.
It was hard to leave. It's like you always want to go back.
You haven't gone back?
No. Like the people that we met there, like it was just like they were so welcoming, and like they would just like whatever was in the freezer, they would share with you. Like it was just a really cool experience.
That's really awesome. And did you stay with host guests or?
We stayed in a flat. So it's kind of like an apartment, but it was like stacked on, up above and like the main area down below.
Okay.
So yeah, it was really neat.
Really cool. So back in the U.S.,
yeah.
Back in Virginia,
yeah.
You also made skin grafts for surgical use from organ donors for a company called LifeNet Health. So how do you make skin grafts?
It's a lot. So that was kind of like doing the aquarium was like I was doing those simultaneous and that was like my sanity because for LifeNet, you're in a class 100 clean room, like bright white lights. You're in a full suit. Like you got the white booties, the white suit, the gloves, the masks, all of it because you can't. Everything has to be very sterile.
Yeah.
So a lot of what you did was keeping everything very clean. But when you get like organ donors, like when you check that on your driver's license, like that goes to helping people either survive or like if something traumatic happens, like to get them better. Breast cancer patients, you know, internal like bladder slings, all sorts of things for these. In, you know, most people know skin grafts are burn victims, which is just one aspect of what they do in that particular department. And so you take the skin from people's backs and then the fronts of their legs, like fronts and backs of their legs. Mm-hmm. And you basically completely denature it, meaning like get rid of the DNA from it. So there's different denaturing solutions that they would have that would denature the DNA. So then it would just become like an object to be used. And so we would have different like sheets that would tell us the sizes that we needed and the thicknesses that we needed. And you're using little scalpels, you know, and different tools that they had. But we had to get rid of all the adipose, which is all the fat layers or if there's any like imperfections like a mole or a tattoo or just anything that would be on those things, which is that like made it real for me. It was like, well, that person had a tattoo right there.
Wow, that's so true.
And
wow.
So I think the biggest challenge, which was something that I didn't even think about at the time, was you have to get rid of every single hair. So like back hair, leg hair, all of it. So you have tweezers and you're literally taking every hair out of that and you're getting rid of the epidermis and it's just the underlayer of it. And so you'd make, you know, squares, little squares, big squares. And then sometimes we would actually use the meshing machine and make mesh grafts that they would use for burn victims.
Wow. And so, excuse me, are these the skin grafts that you make? Are they for that same person or is this a donor? Mm-hmm. It's what you said, it was a donor.
Right, yeah. So they've actually been deceased. They were an organ donor at death. And so their organs were used to help other people.
Yeah.
And this company was really neat because every year, and sometimes multiple times a year, they would have people that were saved by these other donors. And so the family of the donor victim could actually meet the person that it saved, which is pretty cool because we worked with hearts, we worked with skull caps, we worked with a lot of different things. Like if someone had a trauma in their head, they would cut part of their skull plate away and we would store that until their brain swelling would go down. So then the doctors could go back in and put that back.
Wow. Wow. How long, like, could they be in storage? Is that the correct word?
Like the skin grafts themselves?
Yeah, the skin grafts.
It typically was like every week, I mean, like every day you're having a list of which ones need to be made. But the solution that they were put in and the way that they were packaged, like they were well preserved in that sense. And so that it, not necessarily an issue, but typically they were kind of not made to order, but people kind of knew what they needed. Different hospitals or facilities knew like the ones that were like the most needed, just depending on what they did specifically as a doctor.
Wow, that's just absolutely fascinating. All of this is fascinating that you've shared. So we have a couple minutes left. What would you say? Do you have a favorite job that you've had or like a most memorable job? I mean, they're also some of them are very different. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
I think I like the commonality of like how science brings everything together. And there's just so much diversity in it. I think working with animals has always been something that I've just been passionate about. And I think the one that we didn't talk about was the one I was doing right before I moved here. I was working on master formulas and like a quality control inspector for Thorne Research, which is a supplement company. And I loved that because their products are really good in terms of vitamins and just like health stuff. And so I loved that part of it because it's like I love helping people. And so if there's something that I could do to like help get you healthier or on a regimen or different things, or like for me it was post-surgery, like those things helped me a lot on post-surgery stuff. but I was also running dogs in the mountains
of
Idaho at the same time, because again, I love being outside. So with Thorn, I was always inside. And so watching people's dogs or house sitting or dog sitting was cool, but it was like, I kind of want to explore also. And so creating a company called Happy Tails and Trails with a friend, I guess it was just me for a long time, but it just became like taking 1 to 5 dogs with my dog Sage, who's a German short hair. And we'd run them in the mountains, or I would particularly run them in the mountains and look at mountain lakes and different things. And hikers would be going by and like, you have a German Shepherd, a German short hair, a French Bulldog, a Husky. And they're like, what is going on? But they were so happy. And so like getting dogs into the elements and not just like walking them on a leash was just like a really cool thing to do.
Did you have to know if they were like well behaved off leash then?
Typically, yeah. And so I would do a lot of just that individually first to know, like, you know, how will they do with other dogs and things like that.
What if they're runners?
Mm-hmm. Like, then I had to be fast. No, I'm just kidding. So yeah, that was a big part of it. Was like, and usually when people are asking you, like, they're because they're dogs, like they know that they want to just be outside.
Yeah.
And it was like just going step up from walking to like, let's just go off trail.
That's really awesome. I love that. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you would like to share?
I think just kind of rounding it off to Wrangell, like it's just one of those places, like being to so many different places, like you get to meet a lot of really amazing people, but sometimes it can create complications of bigger cities or, you know, like a lot of times I was on bases and stuff. And so it's kind of its own community, but I knew Wrangell was always going to be a part of who I was just because it's been a big part of who my mom is and just having Grandma Ruby and everybody here. And so it made sense that I was going to be here, at least for a time.
Yeah.
And so it's just been kind of a fun, I mean, I wouldn't be here if I wasn't living in Wrangell. So it's been kind of a fun journey, and I know it's not over and I'm excited to see what's next.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your part of your life story with us.
Yeah.
That was Lindsay Morelli.